The world right now is a disaster. It's easy to feel helpless. But there was a moment when millions of people around the world said enough. I'm Sisson Kim Simong. Join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid, how Australians joined others around the world to push back against racism and won.
Whites only teams, we thought that to the average Australian, that would be despicable.
Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. As the United States and Israel rain bombs down on Iran, an uneasy detente has so far survived between Iran and its traditional enemy in the region, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is staying out of it. Later, we're talking to Simon Mabon about that country's difficult position in the war, caught between its old enemy, Iran, and its old ally, America. Plus, we're talking to Margaret Mag Merrilees, lesbian activist of Adelaide, about a long life spent, as she puts it, fixing the world. You'll love her. She's funny and shrewd. But first, to Anna Henderson in Canberra, chief political correspondent with SBS World News. Anna, welcome back to the show.
David, I'm ready to go, and I believe I'm wearing an Akubra tonight, just, you know, so that we can all imagine how deeply engaged I am in the future of the Nationals.
What about that hat that Barnaby was wearing on Insiders with a great brand burnt into one side, SK or something? Now, look, you're a woman from the bush. What was that hat?
Well, Barnaby's always been keen to ensure he's got that hat on. He and Bob Catt are both, you know, they're not to be seen without it. They're actually quite unrecognisable when they have them off. And I think that branding is about, you know, he's got his particular country brands that he likes to promote. Yep. Special boots, special hats. I think they are there's a bit of a message in that to some of the other brands that are available in the bush.
Aha, uh-huh. So there's a subtle message going out there. Do you remember that wonderful old saying from the bush, all hat and no acres?
All hat, no cattle. I mean, I'm familiar with it. But in this case, he does have acres. He's often showing them in the backdrop of his crosses from Danglemar. So,
all right, okay. So there are cattle and acres there. Now, look, we are going to talk Nats and Matt today, Nats and Matt, because this week Matt Canavan became head of the party. What's this going to mean? I mean, can Matt Canavan win a single vote in the city? And doesn't he have to in order for the coalition to work?
I'm not sure that he does. There's a possibility that you have the loose idea of a coalition and a coalition agreement, that secret agreement between the Nationals and the Liberals about the future, but that there is at the moment a fairly clear understanding, I think, from many of the Liberals that the Nationals are going to have to do their thing in the regions because they're fighting off potential challenges from One Nation. Whether One Nation continues to be a force as per the opinion polls up until the next election or if there are flame outs at the moment, like the Liberal Party does in the main, I think, have a bit of an understanding that the Nationals have their own fight to have. And it's better if the Nationals do have that fight on policy without having to be drawn into issues that could lose them like country seats. And so there is a sense that perhaps there can be a differentiation, that the parties do campaign on relatively separate issues and the Liberals are able to do something in the cities that the Nats don't do in the country. But because there had been so many permutations of this now and the ructions between the two parties, they kind of agreed it's better for them to be in a loose alliance than One Nation to be in an alliance at this point. So I think a lot has changed over the time that we've been discussing these issues over the last year or so. And now there's sort of an acknowledgement you know, that Liberals in city seats are just going to have to wear the fact that the Nationals are going to do things that are going to cause trouble for them. That's life.
But that means asking city folk to vote for a coalition, one party of which is led by a person who is absolutely hostile to doing anything about climate change, an absolute spruiker for coal. How can that possibly work?
Well, I mean, it's yet to be seen, isn't it? But I think those really inner city and quite teal seats now that have had a battle over, you know, whether or not climate change is going to be a priority or not, I don't think they're really in the sights of Angus Taylor in the short term. I think he's looking more to the suburbs. He's looking more to small business suburbs and places where One Nation's actually getting quite a lot of traction as well, as to how the Liberal Party can win back, you know, eyeballs and voters in those areas. And he doesn't really need to have a battle about climate change in those seats. According to polling that's been done sort of seat by seat, it's not something that people are largely, you know, I'm stereotyping here, but just based on these focus groups and opinion polls, not particularly exercised about big picture climate change at the moment. The big issues in those seats are definitely sort of economic prosperity or economic pressure, and issues around infrastructure pressure as well. And those questions about, you know, climate policy are not really ones that are being raised regularly in those focus groups. So if you are a Liberal Party looking at that big suburban and outer suburban belt and then the country, it's possible to have a quite different approach to policy than if you're trying to win back, say, Wentworth, Kooyong, those kinds of seats.
But Anna, the policy of going for those suburban seats hasn't worked either. I mean, they haven't got the teal seats, the really prosperous heartland seats of the Liberal Party. They're gone. But they haven't picked up these, you know, supposedly low-hanging fruit of outer suburban seats. They haven't gone to the coalition either.
Well, as one Liberal put to me the other day, maybe we haven't had the right salesperson and the right friendly face.
But isn't
that, and maybe now we do.
But isn't that it? That the hope is that the salesman will come along that will convince Australians to vote for policies that they have long opposed because this brilliant salesman would come along. So how good is Matt Canavan at selling, you know, coal, amongst other things?
I think he is pretty good at selling it, and he seems to have a sort of level of cut through that David Littleproud has kind of struggled with. I mean, David Littleproud, you know, it was quite a surprise that he decided to step back as Nationals leader last week, and it's quite unclear exactly what went into the decision-making process for him, other than he said he was just extremely exhausted by everything that had come before and all the infighting with the Liberal Party and with Susan Lee as Liberal leader.
Hey, just while we're here, in parentheses, the two Barrys,
yes,
Tony Barry and Barry Cassidy, were discussing the possibility that the figures for the National Party in the upcoming by-election for Susan Lee's old seat, which is still some weeks away, but the figures for the Nationals were so diabolical, single figures, that they were going to finish Littleproud off anyway. So he's gone before he was pushed. What do you think of that theory?
Yeah, I think there's merit to that argument. As soon as we were standing at the press conference and David Littleproud was announcing that he was resigning, I sort of thought, well, it's something you might do to save a legacy if you're going to face another spill in sort of 6 weeks, 7 weeks' time and unceremoniously be booted out. And maybe out of this process he did a bit of a deal to retain some kind of front bench portfolio. In the end, he's been handed an, it's quite brutal, but like an outer shadow ministry role. So he's not in shadow cabinet. But perhaps, you know, if he said he was really exhausted by all this process, it's maybe not something that he had the gumption to continue with, and Matt Canavan had to reward all the people who supported him for the leadership in some ways. But yeah, I think the Farah by-election would have been, you know, at least in his mind. And then the reality that if he was to try and hold on to the leadership up until the next election, and then the Nationals really were given a drubbing, that, you know, like, that would be his legacy. His legacy would be sort of running the Nationals into the ground.
Yeah.
But, you know, Matt Canavan, he hasn't even been in the shadow ministry. Like, he's been sort of languishing in this backbench position, just sort of biding his time, making tons of social media videos, and I assume just sort of preparing for the moment where he might strike while the iron was hot. And he hasn't had to, because, you know, largely, I mean, yes, there was a contest for the leadership between him, Kevin Hogan, and Bridget McKenzie, but, you know, he had the numbers in the end. And I think more people believe that he would be able to take the fight to Pauline Hanson and his former boss, Barnaby Joyce.
Ha. But isn't that a return to an old understanding of the National Party, that one nation is not to be toyed with? It is the enemy. You have to fight it. And that spirit seems to come back with Canavan.
He's ready for the fight. And he sort of energised One Nation in some ways as well. They're saying, oh, we're more excited about the contest now. But there is also, I think, this critical meeting of the policy minds in some ways between, you know, some of the things that Matt Canavan and Barnaby Joyce actually are in furious agreement on, and therefore Pauline Hanson. There was a time when people were wondering whether Matt Canavan was going to just defect to One Nation as well. But there's obviously the difference that he's promoted, Senator Canavan, and sees, which is that the Nationals, in his view, are still in a position to be part of a government and to get things done, to make policy, to genuinely deliver for a community, as opposed to, at this point, One Nation, which has never actually been in a position to, you know, direct money or funding in any area. It's been a party of protest and grievance. So Matt Canavan's decided to put his money on remaining in the Nationals and try to make them more viable.
And very interesting, as a deputy leader of the Nationals, Darren Chester. Now, that seems, on the face of it, incongruous. You've got the most old-fashioned pro-coal leader, and you've got Darren Chester, who's a different piece of work entirely.
It was an interesting combo. It wasn't what I was expecting to come out of that party room. I mean, I think we were largely expecting Canavan would be walking out of there victorious. I mean, there were some who said, you know, Bridget McKenzie might have more appeal to a broader section of the regional community, particularly because she's, you know, done a lot of television media and, you know, she's quite well known, and also someone who might appeal more to women in the bush as well, by virtue of the kind of policies that she often talks about. However, in the end, Darren Chester, Gippsland MP, someone who has, you know, in the past sort of distanced himself from Nationals policies at time, hasn't been afraid to speak out even when he was in government, if he didn't agree with the government on a policy, he's managed to end up in this position. I think he's quite chuffed about it, and he sees maybe that he and Matt Canavan can be a bit of a yin and yang in some ways within the party. But it definitely means that the internal politics of the Nationals has shifted for him to be elevated in that deputy role.
And meanwhile, Barnaby, shyly, you know, in a splutter of contradictions and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, wearing his hat, and of course you're right, all hat and no cattle, how could I say acres, has slightly distanced himself from Pauline, because Barnaby knows at least one or two good Muslims.
It's a signal. It certainly is a signal within the Nationals. So Barnaby departs from the Nationals, and he carves out a position within One Nation where he is sort of deferential to Pauline Hanson as the leader and sees them as having this really strong chance of being able to peel off votes nationwide and do something substantial with that polling that they're shifting in their direction. But it's also a signal from Barnaby Joyce to Pauline Hanson that he has a different take on some of the more extreme politics of Pauline Hanson. And so while she will go into the Senate wearing, you know, a burqa type apparel for a stunt and talk about Muslim Australians, of which there are, you know, 700,000 or 800,000 Australians who identify as Muslim, and she will sort of denigrate that religion and culture, question it, and say, you know, that there's something that people who abide to that culture have to answer for. Barnaby Joyce, on the other hand, will try to reshape a One Nation narrative that says that he's not prepared to be that extreme, and that his party that he's now joined has to move with him. So we'll see where that lands, because the party is not just Pauline Hanson, though she is, of course, the most visible and vocal part of the movement. Whether or not in the next few months we start to see any moderation of Pauline Hanson's rhetoric, and we'll see who out of the two of them is winning that power struggle.
Anna, thank you for joining us once again on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. It's always a pleasure, and I'm sure we'll be discussing this for many more months, and we'll see what happens.
All the way to the polls. Thanks, Anna. Coming up, Iran and the Saudis. The two great powers of the Middle East, traditional enemies, lie north and south of the Persian Gulf, Iran to the north and Saudi Arabia to the south. The history of intense rivalry between the two might once have guaranteed Saudi Arabia would be drawn into this war. And a report in the Washington Post a fortnight ago claimed the Saudi leader, Mohammed bin Salman, was urging Trump to begin the bombing. But it's more complex and more interesting than that. To discuss Saudi Arabia's position as the bombs rain down on its old enemy, we're joined by Simon Mabon, a specialist in Saudi-Iranian relations from Lancaster University. Professor Mabon is the author of The Struggle for Supremacy in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and Iran, published a couple of years ago by Cambridge University Press. Simon joins us now. Simon, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Simon, did Saudi Arabia press the United States to attack? The report in the Washington Post is highly confident. It talks of four sources for this story. It's highly detailed. Did it happen in your view?
I think that in 2026, it did not happen. At other points in time, in the recent past, it has happened. And I think given that it's happened in the recent past, there's a bit of credibility to the story that the Washington Post has published. We go back to 2007, and the King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia at the time, called on the United States to, and I quote, cut off the head of the snake. So that's a direct strike on Iran called for by the Saudi monarch from the United States in 2007. In 2019, we were also very, very close after the Saudi oil refineries were attacked by the Houthi militias from Yemen, ostensibly with Iranian support. The Saudis were pretty angry and wanted the United States to respond. That didn't happen. But in 2026, the landscape is very, very different. And I can't believe that Mohammed bin Salman would have invested so much time and energy in trying to transform this deeply antagonistic rivalry and then go to Washington and say, please bomb them. That doesn't add up for me.
How is it that this rivalry has been transformed? Was it Gaza that brought these two nations together?
No, I think it's far earlier than that. I think it goes back to 2019 and a Saudi shift in approach with regard to the United States. This sense of a shift in the way that the Saudis were thinking about how they could rely on the US. So if you go back to the Second World War, there was an agreement reached between Ibn Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia, and the US president at the time for a trade, that the Saudis would guarantee US oil and the Americans would guarantee Saudi security. Now, fast forward to 2019, and you get to a point where the Saudis think, hang on, can we really count on Washington for our security? And I think that really was called into question. And so that contributed to a bit of a shift in Saudi thinking. And at the same time, of course, we've got dramatic changes in the kingdom. We've got an attempt to move away from this reliance on oil, an attempt to try and implement these hugely transformative visions, the Vision 2030 project, the cultivation of neom, the big project called The Line, if you recall. There's lots of things going on. And I think MBS realizes that, well, we can't have that. We can't really reshape our country if we're in the midst of a conflict or indeed a protracted rivalry. And so from 2019 onwards, we start to see the Saudis reaching out to the Iranians reciprocating, and we start to get a softening. We start to get these track two diplomatic initiatives working that bring the two sides closer and closer together. And then in the early months of 2023, we finally see Beijing mediating the final agreement, or facilitating it, depending on your take of the situation, and the two agree to restore diplomatic relations.
Is part of this that the United States needs much less of Saudi's oil?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think that's certainly part of it. We've seen the huge increase in US production of oil, fracking, shale gas, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's also to do with longer term question marks. And this is going to be strange to say at the moment when US forces are embroiled in a horrific bombing campaign. But I think there are existential questions about the role of the US in the Middle East. We saw it under Obama. We saw it under Trump. We saw it under Biden. We saw that the Trump second presidential campaign was predicated on an idea of withdrawing the US from these protracted conflicts. And so I think there was this broader existential debate about what does it mean for the US to be engaged in the Middle East. Of course, all of that seems to have been torn up and changed now.
Have you a view of why the United States joined Israel in this campaign to bomb Iran to smithereens?
I do. I don't think there's a traditional sort of realpolitik reason for it. I think there's a personality politics dynamic to it. I think there's an opportunistic thing to it. And I think there's a sense of supporting Israel in the midst of all of this. So if we think about what happened last summer with the 12-day war, the US and Donald Trump declared victory, declared that the Iranian nuclear program had been destroyed. And then towards the sort of the back end of last year, there was rumors starting to abound that that Iran was working to rebuild its nuclear facilities and rebuild its nuclear program. So we see the starting of this diplomatic initiative. But the US was very clear that it said that it destroyed it all. There were question marks, of course, but Trump was very clear. And then we start to see increasing rhetoric around this idea of stopping Iran's nuclear program once and for all. But we heard that again last year. So there's a question mark about that argument. There's a question mark about the extent to which Iran is supporting its so-called proxies. And I have question marks over the use of the term proxy, but Hezbollah has been dramatically weakened. Hamas is almost destroyed. The Iraqi militias have been embroiled in their own struggles. The Houthis have been embroiled in their own struggles. So Iran's so-called proxy network is far, far weaker than it once was. And so that argument doesn't hold up, that Iran was able to exert all of this nefarious influence on the region at this moment in time. And so then we come to, well, Trump and Netanyahu maybe sensed an opportunity. Netanyahu has had a very strong fixation on Iran's nuclear program dating back 30-odd years. And I think there's maybe a sense that it was opportunistic. Perhaps there's also an argument to say that the Israelis were going to go and that the Americans had to go as well. We don't really know, but that's my take on it, I think. And Trump can now say he's the one that finally took the fight to Iran.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm speaking to Professor Simon Mabon from Lancaster University, an authority on the relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Simon, those two countries do seem to have found common ground in objecting to what Israel's done to the Palestinians. They come together there. Is that now a kind of bond between them?
Yeah, I think there is a sense of the two coming together with regard to solidarity for the Palestinian cause, with regard to opposing what both states describe as a genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. So there is that common ground. But there are other points as well. I think there's a sense that the two were, I guess we're still trying to reckon with where this rivalry is at, where these dynamics are at right now. But they were of the view that the best way for the two states to work together and to thrive was to have them working together for regional security. And that is a dramatic shift in and of itself with regard to how different states in the region envisaged regional security in the Persian Gulf. The Saudis long relied on the US. They were starting to think about an inter-regional form of security cooperation. So we started to see joint military exercises, naval exercises. We started to see a deepening of cultural exchanges. Persian food became incredibly popular in Riyadh, for example. We started to see a shift in the ways in which erstwhile hardline think tanks in Saudi were talking about Iran. They were softening on their approach. So you could see this dramatic change in the ways in which they were speaking about this erstwhile other, this nefarious Iran that was no longer all that nefarious. They were working together. Of course, Gaza solidified that. But now, I mean, who knows?
But Saudi has been hit by Iran since the bombing began on February 28.
Yeah, it has. So the Iranians were very clear at the start, or at least they tried to be very clear, that they were only targeting US bases. So that was their argument. Look, we are not targeting our brothers on the other side of the Gulf. That is not an argument that was bought in Riyadh. It was not bought in Doha, in Abu Dhabi, et cetera, et cetera. The Gulf states, the Arab Gulf states, said this is an attack on our states, our territory. The Iranians rejected that and said, no, we're not attacking you because you are our Muslim brothers.
But all of those Muslim brothers have American bases on their soil. And,
yes.
And in Saudi Arabia, those bases are significant, aren't they? They're big.
Yeah, I mean, they're big across the region. You look at a map of U.S. bases across the Gulf and you see some pretty sizable ones. Al Udeid in Qatar, for example. The Fifth Fleet is based in Bahrain. And so there were pretty serious structural issues, I think, with regard to this broader recalibration of regional security. But I guess the argument was that, look, we're not targeting you. We're targeting the state that is bombing us.
Yeah.
But it was just an argument that did not hold. It did not land well in Riyadh, in Doha, and elsewhere. They said this is an attack on us.
So what was the response of, I love his initials, I don't much love the man, but MBS, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman?
So he was quite vocal in his condemnation of the Iranians, of the war more broadly. There were calls for de-escalation. But it was also in the sense of, well, we are now being attacked by our erstwhile rival. And they say that they're not attacking us, but they are attacking us. And it should be noted as well, I think, that the Iranian attacks gradually sort of started to spread out beyond US bases. So there were thwarted attacks on the airport in Riyadh, for example, on oil refineries, on other non-US related targets in Saudi and indeed elsewhere across the region. And I think that undermines the Iranian argument that this is just an attack on US targets.
But what's been the Saudi response to that?
Well, they've been quite cautious, I think, at present. They've been trying to intercept everything, of course. They've thus far refused to get directly drawn into the conflict. Unlike Qatar, which has directly shot down some planes, I believe, although there is a lot of disinformation out there. So just to caveat that, the Saudis have been quite cautious. And from what I understand, there are still talks going on between the Saudis and the Iranian counterparts. There is still a direct line of dialogue, which is reassuring, because in the past, if this had happened, diplomatic relations would have been cut. Diplomatic relations were cut in 2016 when there were protests and the Saudi consulate in Tehran was set on fire. So the fact that there hasn't been a real cessation of diplomatic relations, I think, tells us something, that there is perhaps a glimmer I mean, there's probably a glimmer that's on life support, but a glimmer of hope that this relationship, this burgeoning relationship, is not dead as yet. But if it carries on much longer, this bombing carries on much longer, there's a good chance that it will be.
Would Saudi Arabia celebrate an Iran that was torn to pieces by this war?
No. No, I really do not believe so. And this goes back to the conversation we were having earlier about stability, about the Saudis realizing that the way that they get to enact their vision, the way that MBS, let's put this very clearly, the way that MBS gets to enact his vision, this isn't a Saudi vision, this is his flagship, the Vision 2030, NEOM, the line, etc., that can only be done with stability. That can only be done with a region that is not beset by conflict. So that's why he was so, or one of the reasons why he was so vocal on what was happening in Gaza. But it's also why I don't think that the Iranians would why the Saudis would celebrate a decimated Iran. They have been very, very anxious about what Iran might look like if it was bombed, and all of the deep schisms with Iranian society within Iranian society were opened up. That would not be helpful for MBS. So no, I really believe that they would not celebrate that.
Because his plan for the post-oil prosperity of Saudi Arabia includes, doesn't it, a lot of tourism. The place has got to be friendly. It's got to be welcoming. It's got to be safe.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of states in the region that are hanging their hat on the tourist hook, if you will. Saudi Arabia and Jordan in particular, we should say. And tourists are not going to go if there is the risk of conflict breaking out, if there's a risk of violence or violent terrorist attacks or anything of the like. And if the situation continues, airlines are not going to fly there. So the Saudis do not want this instability. They want a calm, peaceful neighbourhood.
But they don't need the Strait of Hormuz to get their oil out.
No, but they are also bound up within global supply chains. They are also a key part of those global supply chains. And as a consequence, they do not want the instability that is bound up in the closure of the Strait of Hormuz to affect their own oil prices, their own oil supply, and their own position in the global economy.
And where does this leave them in relation to Israel? What is their attitude to Israel? What challenge, if any, do they present to Netanyahu?
I think that's the million-dollar question, or perhaps the billion-dollar question right now. So back in 2023, prior to October 7, the Hamas terrorist attacks on Israel, there was a lot of talk that the Saudis and the Israelis were about ready to normalize relations. And that would have been hugely symbolic, hugely significant, the last sort of bastion of the Muslim world, leaving Iran aside for now, normalizing relations with Israel. I don't think that they were quite ready to do that. I don't think it was quite as far down the track as many would have us believe. But I think right now, in light of everything that's happened in Gaza, in light of what the Saudis consider to be a genocide, the MBS and others have been very, very clear that they will not consider normalizing with Israel without a Palestinian state being set up. And so that's very, very clear to me. And MBS has said, look, I can't do it for fear of being assassinated. And he's obviously alluding to Anwar Sadat, who was killed after signing a diplomatic treaty with Israel. So there's a precedent there, I think. But there's also the sense that, well, the Israelis and their policies with regard to the West Bank, with regard to Gaza, are making it so that a Palestinian state is inviable. And if that's the case, then we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I'm not sure that the Saudis can normalize with Israel right now.
If a Palestinian state becomes less and less possible.
Yeah, exactly. And the recent legislation that's been passed that allows for settlement building in certain parts of the West Bank, that calls for new forms of legal documentation to demonstrate property ownership, that allows particular people to buy land in the West Bank if there is no legal claim over that land, and this is a dramatic shift from what had happened in the preceding years, then that all makes the idea of a Palestinian state that includes the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to non-adjacent parts of territory, it must be said, even more difficult. So, yeah, I think it's really tricky.
But one last complication in all of this. Why has Saudi Arabia signed up to Trump's Board of Peace?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. I mean, perhaps it's the sense that if they're involved, they can have a say. If they're involved, they can try and influence the discussions that are happening there. Perhaps it's to continue to try and exert influence over Trump himself. I mean, the Saudis, the Al Saud, I should say, and Donald Trump and his close family have endured quite a positive relationship over the years, but I don't think that the Saudis want to be left on the outside of all of these discussions. And perhaps it's also an attempt to have a say in the reconstruction of Gaza. I mean, ultimately, we just don't know because we're not privy to the internal sort of thought processes that MBS and his close circle have. But that would be what I would suspect.
They want to be at the table.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a good way of putting it.
Simon, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I've been talking to Professor Simon Maybon, Professor of International Politics at Lancaster University, specialist in Saudi-Iranian relations, and author, a couple of years ago, 2023, of The Struggle for Supremacy in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and Iran, published by Cambridge University Press. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, A Sweet Disobedient Life. Back in the 70s, when Adelaide was the radical hope of Australia, Meg Merrilees joined the rush of, and this is her list, lesbian feminists, radical lesbians, separatists, socialist feminists, anarchist feminist lesbians, to that, her words again, dry, flat provincial city, to work out new ways to live and new politics to fight for. Meg is still there, still fighting for a better future, and she's written her memoirs, Scared, Angry, Laughing, or How to Fix the World. It's many things, a slim, shrewd, funny, unique history of a battling woman's life. And Meg joins me now from Adelaide. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
Buried in the book, I think, is one of the most important declarations you make, and I would like you to explain it. I am essentially a good girl.
Well, you know, I was brought up by ex-communist parents, so they weren't even in the party by the time I can remember. But they didn't go back to being normal either, of course. But my mother particularly was she was pretty keen on manners. She'd grown up with a lot of manners. So she made sure we dotted our I's and crossed our T's and said please and thank you and so on.
And presented a respectable face to the world.
A respectable, that's right. If you're going to have radical views, you could at least present as respectable.
And did this mean that you were not going to, say, lob hand grenades, you were not going to put tree trunks across the train tracks? There would be limits to your political activity.
I don't think she minded if we didn't have limits, as long as we, you know, we'd... My father was a case in point. He was, I've never met a more courteous man. You know, one of my early memories was the police coming to the door during the Vietnam moratorium times because he'd put his name to an ad in the paper or something. And he was completely courteous with the police. I never saw him be anything other than courteous.
But, Meg, that's true of the memoir that you've written, is that courtesy, even to the police, even when they are arresting you, is part of it. I mean, you know, rage, but courtesy. You know.
Well, hey, David, I'm white, I'm middle class, I'm 70-something, I'm, you know, the police are going to be cautious around me anyway. I'm sure I'd feel differently if I was young and black and... or Palestinian or whatever.
I don't know that they would necessarily have been all that kind to you if you'd been, say, in Sydney a couple of weeks ago demonstrating against...
Well, that's true.
Yes. But now, look, tell me about your first arrest. Why were you arrested?
1983, there was a big women's gathering at Pine Gap, hundreds of women, to protest about the, let's call it the spy station. It's just played its part, as we know, in the current mess. So it was a demand to close Pine Gap. So we pushed the gates down, basically, and then gathered inside and thought, oh, now what will we do? So we walked up the road to have a look at the spy station of the police. There were Commonwealth police there as well as Northern Territory police, but they were a bit outnumbered. Anyway, they herded us, rounded us up eventually and put us in the men's cells in the Alice Springs Watch House, which was a really chillingly horrible experience spending the night there, in that it was a reminder of what Aboriginal people in Alice Springs were experiencing every night. Some people in the street told us the next day that that was the first time there hadn't been any Aboriginal men in those cells in Alice Springs.
Because they were full of women.
So that was a learning experience for sure.
And when you discovered that the employees at Pine Gap had hurriedly fixed a fresh gate, what was the response to that?
We wrote on it, of course. Congrats, boys, on a hasty erection.
Ridicule matters in politics, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Well, I think it matters everywhere, doesn't it? We'd go mad if we couldn't laugh.
Meg, what was it like to go to Adelaide in the 1970s? What was the city like?
It was small. So it was I'd been living in Melbourne, and Adelaide was a much more manageable place. It was, you know, if you remember the Central Market, you ran into people you knew in the Central Market. And, of course, the main thing was it was the legacy of Don Dunstan. You know, the impact that he'd had, the homosexual law reform, but more than that, the impact that he'd had on in all sorts of ways. I mean, you know, the Pink Shorts Press, who published this book,
as named after the famous
pair. The famous pair of pink shorts. And, you know, the story I've heard, I don't know whether this is confirmed or not, was that when Dunstan, he snuck out of Parliament House and posed for the media in the pink shorts, he had escaped from his handlers or his minders or whatever they were in order to do that. He may not have had the full support of his parliamentary colleagues, but that in itself, I think,
The pink shorts. But I wonder whether there was a sense that this was a small town, that it was a manageable town where you knew people.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Therefore, the kind of informal political activity that was your life could be effective.
Yes. There were debates, of course, within that, because it was, you know, one of the first places to have a women's advisor to the Premier, for instance. And there were lots of things like that going on. But it was interesting, coming from Melbourne, some of us thought that it would be compromising our politics to go along with government-funded services and so on, that we wouldn't be able to be quite so loud-mouthed and...
I can hear that argument, Meg. I can hear that argument, yes. We must be entirely separate. We must be pure.
Yes, exactly. We must. And if we're not throwing stones, we're failing. And I think in a city this size, you can see that development from that oppositionalism, if I can call it that, to a strong sense of community. I mean, I think the Constellations Festival that happened just a few weeks ago is a case in point. Like, for a community of this size to be able to pull together a few days, more than a few days, quite a number of events just like that was... And local writers, it was a great opportunity for local writers, bookshops, publishers, all sorts of people, writers got involved and managed to pull this thing off.
a writers' festival to replace Writers' Week that had collapsed. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Mag Merrilees about this beautiful memoir she has written of her political and other life. Are you enlisted for frontline duties? Do people ring you up and say, now that we've got this demo going, Mag, we need you in the front line?
No. No, I'm not as heroic as that. But we've got a good thing going here, actually, which is called Community Defenders. It's a group of people who will surround, especially something like that, where people of colour or people who are vulnerable are trying to have some sort of protest, then make a buffer zone around it of people with some training, non-violence training, not to take over the role of the police, but just to be a sort of a protective layer, trusting that the police will then deal with any violence that threatens from the outside. And this group of people will make sure that things are okay on the inside. So that's interesting. I did go to Newcastle 1 year.
What was that all about? That,
well, it was about that's. This is called Rising Tide, and they're a very canny group of people, young people, all sorts of people. Newcastle, they say, is the biggest, I think, coal port in the world in terms of the amount of coal that gets shipped out of there every day. And so this has been an annual protest to try and just shut the harbour down for a day or more to, once again, it's about getting people to think, making people aware that this is happening. Like, this is, you know, we're pretending that we're doing something about the climate crisis, but we're still shipping out more coal than anyone else in the world. So that protest, you know, very clear that this has to be about changing new job opportunities for the people who will lose their jobs when the coal industry is finally shut down. So it's not a short-sighted protest.
But, Mag, looking back on your life, do you think demos work? Do you think demos have impact, can produce change?
I don't know the answer to that, David. I wish I did. I don't block streets anymore. It just irritates people. They want to get to work, and I don't think stopping them from getting to work is the most effective way of changing their minds about anything. You know, I think actually one of the important ways they work is for the people who are doing the demonstrating, because I think it's important to get out there and see that you're not on your own and that there are other people, and that if we do it together, perhaps we can do it. So there's that. But I've for some time now, I've tended to do more localised things, or not road blocking anyway.
Tell us about the Santos demo.
Yes, well, that's a case in point. Well, that was a group of us south of the city, all women, thinking what to do. And honestly, we had signs that said we tried polite. And, of course, we have tried polite. All of us have tried everything and had no impact in terms of Santos sponsorship. And Santos and the South Australian government are particularly cosy in bed together. So I'd made banners. My last lot of banners, the letters were 2 metres high. That's spelled out.
Great.
Only one earth. Anyway, still didn't seem to be working, so we decided we would do this thing at the Tour Down Under, at the women's race. We'd let the women riders go past, but then we had flaps that dropped down. That's a row of 10 of us. And when we dropped our front flaps and showed our breasts, they read Santos sucks, one letter each. And then we turned round and dropped a flap off our bums, and that read dump Santos. The funny follow-up to that is that this year at the Tour Down Under, a couple of the veterans of that event, hung the, we didn't wear them, but they hung them up on a string between two trees so that the riders and all the support vehicles and so on, the media and everyone could see them as they went past. The people who recognised them immediately were the police.
They had longer memories.
They did, and I think they'd probably enjoyed it, actually.
Were you arrested? Were you charged with...
Yes, we were three of us were charged with indecent behaviour. So we appeared in court numbers of times with signs that said, actually, we're decent people. And the police prosecutor and our lawyer exchanged, speaking of courtesy, extremely courteous letters backwards and forwards, and finally the police withdrew the charges mysteriously to me. I mean, you know, it wasn't indecent. You could see something more indecent than that any day on the beach.
Oh, honestly, Mag, you don't back away from the power of your own demonstration by saying such things. Then no one's going to believe you.
Well, the thing is, you don't very often see 70-year-old bums and breasts on the beach. I guess that might be the indecent bit.
Are demos, are protests cleverer now than they were when you were young?
I don't know if the protests are clever or I just a bit less naive than I was back then. But I think I'm so impressed by these young people who are stepping up. They're sharp. They know what's going on. They can see what the future might hold. They know what needs to be done. They have courage. I think they're fantastic.
So what's the cause of choice at the moment and how are you addressing it?
I think I, you know, writing this book, I think I'd have to say at the moment, my intent with the book is serious. The tone isn't serious, but, you know, any way we can get people to think. It's such a precarious moment, and I don't know about you, but it's a weird position to be in, to be looking towards the end of your own life because of your age and also contemplating the possibility of the end of civilization as we know it. Maybe in some ways that makes it easier to look at the end of civilization because your own life is winding up anyway. Or we're going to at some stage.
Oh, yes, because we can leave it to the young. You know, they're the ones that are going to have to deal with it. But I wonder whether you are now, and you and your friends, are sort of invulnerable now. You're old. You're not going to be roughed up by the cops.
No, that's right.
You're invulnerable.
Well, as long as we don't come to Sydney, as you say. But, yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, I've got a pension and so far nobody has threatened to take it away from me if I don't behave. I live in a house that my partner owns. I'm white-haired, I'm respectable, I'm, you know, if I can't speak my mind and be in the front line at a demo, then who can, really?
Mag, look, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
That's a real pleasure. Thank you for having me, David.
I have been talking to Margaret Merrilees, writer, activist, and author of this beautiful book that's come out. It's 133 pages long, Mag. It's so short and tight and funny and vivid, and it's lovely, absolutely lovely. It's called Scared, Angry, Laughing, or How to Fix the World. Published by Pink Shorts Press, of course. And that's the show. After his Australian triumph, Ian Dunt is back doing what he does best, taking the piss out of Britain. Can't wait. And Geoffrey Watson is joining us to give Robodebt the last rites. All the cruelty, all the illegality, all the political conniving, yet none of the big figures that ran Robodebt for years face punishment. So Australian.
Thank you.